In August, our extended family, which is spread many miles apart and always has been, gathers for a week on Squam Lake in New Hampshire. One of my brothers and I have had a ritual over the last 30 years or more of swimming every morning at 7 o'clock, I beg your pardon, before breakfast. Just the two of us, as nobody else seems to think crawling out of a warm bed to go swimming at that hour is a great idea. They're missing something spectacular and holy. It's so beautifully quiet on the lake in the morning. Sometimes when we swim out of our protected bite, we see the sun coming up just over Red Hill. Sometimes we see little tufts of cloud tucked into the pockets of the slopes to the west. My brother calls them prophet's fires. As though there it might be some itinerant preacher there, waking up and cooking breakfast for another day. I love that image. We swim out to a marker and then tread water for a while, and we chat and see what we see before we swim back in. The view at the waterline is quite something. The week was cold this year. Many days, you might remember, lingering in the 60s. It was the week right before Labor Day. And nights were in the 40s. It was chilly swimming by the end of the week. A bit raw, actually, but we were rewarded. There are loons on this lake that we hear often with their ethereal cries. Last year, one popped up about 30 feet or so away from us. It didn't have much to say, but it was beautiful company the way their heads go like this, right above the edge of the water. And this year, on the last morning, we saw one fly up from the east, arcing directly over our heads. We had never experienced that before. It flew up and over us, calling out as it gently landed and then ducked underwater. Huh, my brother said, that was something. Yes, it was. It felt like a blessing itself and a little farewell to summer. I am not an extraordinary outdoors person. I don't hike much. I don't know much about forests or the habitats of wild animals. I wouldn't know a poisonous mushroom from an edible one, so I wouldn't try. I'm embarrassed to admit I don't even compost yet. Yukiko composts. I bet many of you do too. But I know that a relationship with the natural world is a good and imperative thing, because aside from all the benefits of feeling the wind in our hair or the sun on our shoulders or the rain on our lips, and aside from the relationships with creatures other than human that fill spaces in our wanting hearts, the relationship with all that is other than human puts us in our place. We too often think the world is all about us and our devices and our comfort. We shouldn't need Harvey or Irma or the death of a loon to be reminded that we are only one piece of this vast creation. I've been trying to figure out why we have increasingly separated ourselves from the natural world. I read E. Annie Proulx's remarkable book, Barkskins, last summer. Has anyone read that? It's really thick and big. She is a master of detail, which is why it's really thick and big. And it traces the relationship between humans and trees, for the most part, primarily trees on the North American continent over the last 400 years or more. It's heartbreaking because we're forced to see how we have destroyed something ancient in service to our human needs. Wants is perhaps more accurate. At one point in the story, the native people in what we now know, or now know as Canada, are confused about why all these Europeans have come to cut timber to make boxes to live in. You can't move boxes. Teepees move. Why do these people fix themselves to a space so inflexibly and then insist they own it? You know, the boxes are houses, right? You got that. Things change, of course, numbers change and needs change. The shape of life and communities and structures of living change. We are no longer an agrarian culture for the most part. As our friend from the band Cloud Cult reminded us, the image of 250,000 relatives all having a common reality, while two, just two, are clueless, is a bit sobering. This change has happened so quickly that most of us don't live off the land anymore, is what it is. But it doesn't mean we have to abandon our relationships. In fact, I think we do so at our emotional and spiritual peril. Dan and I have lived in our home in Newton for nearly 30 years, which is stunning to me, but still. And I've watched the houses around us become kind of increasingly separate from each other. They appear to have isolated inward. Our neighbors have built, for example, attached garages, which means we don't see them coming and going anymore, except in their cars. We don't meet casually unloading our groceries or arriving home from work. Most have gotten central air conditioning, which means they don't open their windows, so we don't hear each other anymore, which is sometimes a good thing. Those with children put swing sets in the yards, which means they don't go to the park as much. Now we're not just cutting ourselves off from the natural world, but from each other. And you know what? I think we're unconsciously trying to protect ourselves from something, from hurt or discomfort or pain. In the name of convenience or stability or maybe safety or predictability, but it's not likely to work. In fact, I suspect that the less experience we have with the wonders of the natural world or even with the simple realities of things like dirt or heat or wet or cold, the whims and mess of the animal world or even the insect one, the less prepared we are to manage our lives when our hearts are broken open, which they will be. We will have lost context. We will have lost a kind of balance that we learn from the chaos that is nature. We humans imagine, or like to imagine, we can control life and protect ourselves. But it's not true. I remember a religious education retreat from a number of years ago with a storyteller who commented that her neighbor called her one morning to say that her electricity was out, and she couldn't get the weather forecast on her TV, and she wondered if the woman she called had her electricity so she could get the forecast. And the storyteller told us that what she wanted to say was, "Have you looked outside?" But now, of course, we have an app for that, so we don't need our electricity. It's hard to live with our hearts open wide, isn't it? Sometimes it just hurts. Maybe we imagine if we limit the number of things we're connected to emotionally, we'll have that much less to lose. But I fear we will have lost so much more. In the offertory that the choir shared this morning are the words, "Nature's great community welcomes us." I hope we can find ways to re-welcome it in return. Not so much as a function of dominion. We, I think, are gotten a little carried away with that concept, but more importantly, welcome the great community as teacher, to be in relationship that is reciprocal and engaged. Nature is the cycle of birth and death over and over again in far more rapid succession than human life is typically. It has so much to teach us. It doesn't mean we won't get hurt, that we won't suffer loss. Quite the opposite, but that we might know how to manage it, how to fold it into the rhythm of our lives, how to understand our beginnings and our endings, how to seek wisdom in the timeless being of creature and earth. We blessed our children this morning and all creation. How will we remind them that this is our call, to welcome the lessons of the great community, to know that every sign of the world's exuberance, including change and loss and death, is holy? What will they see around us that acknowledges our indebtedness and our connectedness? For whatever we have lost of that relationship, we can restore. Imagine if our children could sit in conversation with the 250,000 behind us and have something to say. This place, this great community we call home, will be here far longer than we will be. Let it be our teacher and guide, our lover and friend. Let it call us to broken hearts, broken open, and never to close again. So may it be.